independent look at the output of the media from one conflict and a very similar one, and you can compare them. So it's a huge, really, amount of work. Whether anyone is a propagandist or not, that's not the point. It's the point is looking at the final output and how did it get there. Now, you put forward explanations of how it may have happened, but really the point is, here's what did happen. Here's this output, and here's that output. Remarkably similar conflicts. How come this is the output here, and how come it's completely different here? And Chomsky's model is that the output will prioritize power, and so it does.
And what about some of the personalities involved in both conflicts? Yeah.
So for me then, I had to look at people who had, you know, reported in Algeria and reported in the conflict in the north of Ireland. So that was sort of hard to find, but I eventually did find 10 people, which was great for me. So these people are actually eyewitnesses to the Algerian conflict and eyewitnesses in Ireland. And why they're so important is, what you learn is ideas that they have internalized. Now remember, I've got an advantage over them because I'm reading everything at the time. My advantage is they might know their little corner of the conflict, but I've looked at the whole lot. And most of them have internalized wrong ideas. I'll give you a small example. For these British journalists who had been in Algeria and the same in Ireland, they would always say to me, oh, Ireland is, you know, not as bad as Algeria because of this incident called the Rue de Isly massacre, which is basically Bloody Sunday in Algeria. If you look at the figures for the Bloody Sunday killings and the Rue de Isly, the Rue de Isly, there were more people killed, about 45. The difference is this. What happened on the Rue de Isly was the French soldiers opened fire for 7 minutes. They opened fire, 9 of them. The eyewitnesses, these British journalists who were there, saw their officers slapping their faces to get them to stop. Bloody Sunday is different. There are less people killed, but behind it, there's a much more sinister thing going on. Ministry of Defense, making the soldiers go up on that day, filling their heads full of what they're going to do. So, the numbers are smaller, but what happened in Algeria was a spontaneous, terrible event, Bloody Sunday. There's far more behind it. But nobody, these journalists all had it the other way around.
What was the role? I mean, Conor Cruz O'Brien, who became Minister of Posts and Telegraphs in the Dublin government, and who was instrumental in police and censorship with Section 31. What was his role in terms of the coverage of Algeria?
Yeah, so Conor Cruz O'Brien was a big sort of an expert. He sort of fell in love with Algeria. He worked in the French embassy in Paris at the time, and so he had a lot to say on Algeria, and he wrote about Camus and their very famous books and everything. And basically, O'Brien himself acknowledges that he was a big advocate for the FLN, who were like extremely ruthless. Not to me to deny these people their independence, but the FLN and the ALN themselves will acknowledge how ruthless they were. Conor Cruz O'Brien cheered them on. But O'Brien is important for us because O'Brien, his analysis of the conflict in the north of Ireland basically framed nearly all of the media analysis in the British media on Ireland. O'Brien, basically his ideas, framed it all. To shorten it, it was a religious conflict, not the legacy of colonialism. The other way around in Algeria, Algeria was written up as the classic anti-imperial war. There was, in fact, a great deal of a religious dimension behind it. So the two things are sort of stood on their head.
And what about that journalist John Cole, who was from Belfast? He became a political correspondent in London. And how did he frame the presentation and the perception of our conflict here?
So Cole is very much like Conor Cruz O'Brien because he's a pivotal person in the presentation of the conflict in Ireland. He's the sort of in-house expert for The Guardian and Observer at the time. At the time, seen as, you know, the most left-wing and progressive newspapers. But John Cole himself would have been described in his obituary as a true Protestant son of Belfast, meaning he was a real unionist. However, Merlin Rees, Reginald Maudling, Jim Callaghan, all of them went to him for advice. His view of the north of Ireland went in the Guardian.
So what other observations did you make about the British media's role in our conflict here?
O'Brien and Cole basically turned the Algerian analysis on its head. The Algerian conflict does have a religious dimension and an anti-imperial dimension, but it's portrayed as the classic anti-imperial struggle, and the religious dimension is overlooked. Whereas in the north of Ireland, they boosted this religious angle and pushed aside almost entirely the legacy of colonialism. So they basically turned it on its head. But there were so many similarities. So sometimes the people who gave it away are very interesting. So, for example, Noel Little, Emma Little Pengelly's father, who's a gun runner. Now, Emma, they asked him, why did you do it? Very interestingly, he said, to stop Britain doing in Algeria. I remember going, good man, Noel, you know what you're talking about. But everybody else denies it. But the French Parliament referred to Algeria as France's Ireland. Mm-hmm. They knew. And Harold Wilson, when his cabinet secretly discussed withdrawn
from the north.
From the north, they discussed withdrawn under the code word Algeria. This is the place that everybody tells me it's not the same. And there are American academics who, when they first came over and recorded British soldiers here, the officers now, they're all saying things like this. Oh, yeah, the French have been through all this in Algeria. All these things get written out of the media, but you see, I have the original ones. So you say, how do these things disappear? But then it gets even more interesting. Then you get Kitson himself, who quotes Colonel Roger Trinquier. Now, Roger Trinquier was right at the heart of the Battle of Algiers, and he made no bones about it. You have to torture these guys to get information out of it. Now, not all the French officers wanted to torture them, because a lot of them knew it doesn't work anyway. People under torture will tell you anything.
Yeah.
You see, but Trinquier, he believed no torture them, and Kitchen quotes Trinquier. And so he followed Trinquier. But, the similarities, Danny, are beyond belief. Lord Carrington, who resigned over the Falklands but didn't resign over torture. Now, we now know that Carrington signed off on the torture.
Man, yeah.
At the time, we didn't know. But when the Compton Inquiry was first written on the torture here in the north, Compton quotes almost verbatim Pere de la Rue, who was the chaplain to the paratroopers in Algiers. And his famous quote was, you have to do this. Don't take any joy out of it, but it's a necessity. And if you read through Compton, you go, I read this before. That's Pere de la Rue. There are similarities, but it goes even further than that. So if you, there are more similarities. And it's the other way this time. It's the Algerians looking at Ireland. And the original Algerian, the ALN, took their inspiration from Michael Collins. And so, and they're as schoolboys. They're all going, this Michael Collins guy's great. These IRA guys are great. They get Ireland out from under Britain. And these are boys at school who grow up to be the leaders of the Algerian rising. So the Algerians are copying the Irish, and the British are copying the French in Algeria.
Well, the thing is, of course, whenever de Gaulle betrayed the army, so to speak, there was a reaction against de Gaulle, you know, and the attempts of explosions and attempts of assassination, etc. But there was no similar thing here in Britain by the army, apart from 1974, what's it called, Operation Clockwork Orange.
Yes, uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's a really good example, Danny, because, you see, the French, in a sense, are way more honest than the British. There's a real political divide in France. So, and even the French officers, like, debated in public about the torture. And you had other French officers say, no, we can't do that. It brings dishonor on the French army. So they are discussed. I'm not excusing the French. I'm just saying they're open about it. Whereas the British, you know, we never tortured. It doesn't come out at all. So there was opposition to de Gaulle in the French, but the British army never got any opposition. And the British army, you know, soldiers would sit down with the, you know, head of the opposition. They all went to school together in a sense. Mm-hmm. So there was never that real division that the British army would be upset with their political leadership, because the political leadership in Britain never went against the army. Mm-hmm. The army asked for it, they got it. Do you know who we know who we can thank for that? Garrett Fitzgerald, because he's the one that told us. It's just, when the British sit down with their generals, if the generals ask for it, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's Garrett. He was in the IRA, wasn't he?
His father was in the GPO. So it ends with the decolonization of Algeria. It ends with the Pied Noir, vast majority of them, going back to France.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the term settler colonialism is seen as pejorative, and the unionists have taken exception to it, even though in the past they have used the term.
Well, you're so right, Danny, and I did face opposition from people saying to me, you know, this is a pejorative term against unionism. Look, in academia, it is not. It's an explanatory tool. So when we talk about settler colonialism, what we're talking about is, if you talk about colonialism, you're talking about an invasion. But settler colonialism is a structure. In other words, the invasion never stops. It just keeps on going. That is, you have a structure of displacing the people before. Now, that's been overturned quite a bit with the Good Friday Agreement. So this idea of being called a settler, you will get young progressive unionists today who find it, you know, it's difficult if you're a young progressive unionist because of this colonial label hanging over them. And it sits uneasily off the shelf of a liberal Protestant. But look, for the longest time, Paisley, for example, would have went on about his good settler stock. You know, it would have been an honorific in the mm-hmm. past. But after the Second World War, you know, if you're the colonist, basically you're the bad guy. You're the one that caused the trouble, not the guys who are fighting against you. In fact, it seems that the natives, if we call the Irish the natives or the Algerians the natives, I mean, it's a pretty rational thing to do, to try and oppose what's being done on you. So the violence then comes initially from the settler. So settler colonialism is difficult for a progressive young unionist, but it's a tool that's used all around the world. It explains Algeria, it explains Australia, America, Argentina. They don't like to use it here, but it explains the north of Ireland too. So, yes, people don't like it because, well, it really means the focus shouldn't be on the rebels, the IRA. The focus should be on the settlers and the policies of London. What's the cause of all this? And hence we get this problem about rewriting the past, which is a bugaboo for all of unionism.
Well, Pat, thanks for coming along today. That was a fascinating insight into the parallels between Ireland and Algeria and on the whole subject of media distortion of our conflict here. And that's it for another week. The conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. Until next time, I'm Danny Morrison, and this has been The Conversation. Bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge with Sheikh Mukhtar on IRIB English Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on one of the phrases in the 185th sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And in that phrase, Imam Ali alayhi salam warns us of an important issue, and that is that if a society gets too much engrossed in blessings, that can lead to a certain form of drunkenness, a spiritual drunkenness. If a person would achieve that, or you can say that type of difficulty faces the community whereby they become drunk because of these blessings, then know that the community will not be able to achieve its goals, its aims and objectives. Rather, things will be going in the opposite direction. Inshallah, we shall see and discuss in this session what are those problems that a person can face, what are those difficulties that can overcome the society and make it not achieve its goals and aims because of these blessings.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created the heavens and the earth and all of that is within there as a test for mankind. One of the most important things that a person needs to realize in his life is that everything in a certain form or way can be counted as a test. That includes blessings. You know, sometimes we feel tests are just difficulties that we face in life, but rather sometimes blessings become even a bigger test for a community. One of the problems that happens when a person has a lot of physical blessings, and if a community gets a lot of physical blessings and these physical material blessings are not channeled, are not are not organized in a way that can lead to the development of the community, normally these blessings end up causing class differences in the society. So Even if you look into history, and even today, if you want to look at the wealthy communities, the wealthy countries, let's say, which have a lot of wealth, many times when this wealth comes, and if it is not planned and organized well, it normally leads to an increased, you can say, difference in the classes of the society. So the poor class and the distance between the poor class and the rich class increases. And this is basically because of not planning these things well. But as I said, this is one of those harms that can befall a community. And therefore, a community needs to be very careful to be able to plan for these problems. And that would be to promote systems, to promote ways and methods in which this wealth that is there can be divided in an accurate way. But sometimes even the community and the society and the leadership might place these laws, these rules and regulations, but because the person involved himself is not ready and prepared to receive all of these physical blessings spiritually, that person may not abide by those systems, may fool, may trick, may, you know, do all of these different corrupt methods to become richer and richer. This is a possibility, and it's something that we've seen that happens in the society.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Nahjul Balagha, translated as the Peak of Eloquence, is a compilation of sermons, letters, and sayings that reflected Imam Ali's profound insights on governance, ethics, spirituality, and social justice. Sayyid Razi's meticulous work in preserving and presenting Imam Ali's words has made Nahjul Balagha a timeless source of inspiration for scholars, theologians, and seekers of wisdom.
Now, we say that these blessings, that when they come into a society, a person should quickly gather himself, right? A person should not be just happy that, oh, now we struggled all these years, now we have to achieve the results of our struggles, now let us have a lot of blessings and let us be happy with these blessings. You know, sometimes this kind of attitude overwhelms people. And that includes the Islamic society at that time. So when these blessings came, one of the effects was there was a division in terms of class. Some people became very rich, while others remained to be poor. The government, of course, could have created systems, but then the people have to abide by those systems. So it now comes down to the point that some people are not prepared for these blessings. We have got examples in history. So what is that preparation that a person needs to have for these blessings to come, and so that he can use them in the right way? That preparation is simply to understand and to inculcate inside one's heart the obedience of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, number one. Number two, the piety that a person needs to have with regards to the duties that Allah has prescribed. And number three, the moral fabric of a person should be coordinative, or you can say it should be compatible to what we call zuhd and asceticism. Not that asceticism in terms of leaving all the physical pleasures and blessings, no, but rather to be able to not be attached to these things. So a person needs to inculcate, and that needs planning. That means that needs training. So when a person is working hard to earn a lot of money, at the same time praying to Allah to earn and to get a lot of physical blessings and material blessings, at the same time he should pray to Allah that he gives him the ability and the courage and the strength to be able to earn the necessary traits to protect himself and his iman, and to be able to use the wealth for the progress of the society. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar in the program Gate of Knowledge on RIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives, but in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for four hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen.
And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon. The result? The pressure was inflicted anyhow. The prosecutor himself considers that Google, as much as the search engine is concerned, is not responsible for the data processing. Accordingly, Mario's complaint is inadmissible. But the last word in this affair, after being deliberated upon, would be rendered by the judge of the European Court.
We've been working on this case for several years. I think when we heard the ruling from the European Court of Justice, so we were somewhat surprised. And again, we thought the ruling was flawed and continue to think that and think there should be a dialogue in Europe about how to implement the right to be forgotten and perhaps through legislation or other dialogue figure out a way to implement it perhaps in a more focused way.
So the question is, how can we achieve this control over our digital identity? It turns out that it appears that there's at least a very good solution, maybe not a perfect solution, that's relatively easy to achieve. It requires that people be given notification when there's data recorded about them. It requires that people knowledgeably understand what's happening with that data and have the right to say what happens with data about them.
I take that seriously when a former CIA director says that my client should be hung by his neck from a tree, should be lynched. When the former director of NSA jokes with the chair of the House Intelligence Committee about putting my client on the assassination list.
The Washington Post, U.S. mines internet firm data, documents show. The second document, which was published again, shook the planet. The code name of the program, PRISM, collection details. For the first time, it came to light that the NSA had enlisted large internet groups for surveillance purposes. In this document, there is a list of the companies and all the areas to which the agency can access. The internet has become the main vector of the mass surveillance model, which affects everyone.
I think tragic things that came out of the Snowden revelations were this impression that companies or that Google was indiscriminately sharing information with the U.S. government or the NSA. Nothing could be further from the truth. The only thing that we do is to respond to narrowly tailored legal requests from the government. It could be law enforcement and it might be national security. But we are very, very diligent about protecting our users' information, pushing back against the government when we feel that they've gone too far, and making sure that we're transparent about that. Transparent about, we publish something called the Transparency Report, where we make clear what we've done with respect to information that we've given to governments. But I can't state this more strongly. There was no backdoor into our systems. We were not working cooperatively with the NSA and sharing our users' information in any way, shape, or form other than to respond to their legal requests.
Ashkan Soltani has even developed the investigations further, demonstrating that the globalization of the information systems is an advantage for the actions of the NSA.
There is also a second set of access by the government that I've written about and that with Bart Gellman about how, in addition to going directly to Google and saying, give me everything on Ashkan, the government goes and collects data from the links between Google's data centers, right? So Google has a data center here in North Carolina. Google has a data center, I think, in Iceland, right? And when I type an email, right, because of the way the cloud works and it backs up my data all over the world, that email that I kind of write in the data center in North Carolina also gets copied to Iceland, right? And the NSA maintains and monitors those communications as well, and they, unbeknownst to Google, access that data. And that's something that they, the companies themselves, were very frustrated about. Because on one hand, they're forced to directly give information via Prism, and they're also able to, the government's able to get it themselves, help themselves to it through the back door.
The shockwaves of Snowden's revelations rock the web giants. Western intelligence services feel ridicule when faced with the excesses of the NSA, and so they demand that the U.S. be held accountable. Bernard Barbier was one of the key leaders of the Directorate General for External Security, DGSE, when the case broke up. This shadow man spoke for the first time before the media. At the highest European level, politically speaking, this new and exceptional context overwhelms the rules. 99% of the phone communications and the global internet are transited via an intercontinental network of submarine cables and optical fibers. It's through these nerve centers that the digital data is intercepted and collected. Britain's government communications headquarters, the Intelligence Service of His Majesty, plays a crucial role in this system. The Guardian newspaper published a document confirming that the GCHQ gathers and shares communications, emails, and Facebook posts with the NSA, namely all the data passing through these underwater cables. Sir David Ormond, the former director of the British Intelligence Services and then a professor at King's College London, was at the heart of the global eavesdropping system. He knew about the existence of Tempora.
The GCHQ's Tempora is, in a sense, a buffering program because of the enormous volumes of information passing through the internet and passing through all these fiber optic cables and giant pipes through which the internet works. It's simply not possible to do all the processing in real time. So it's taken, stored for a limited period so that it can be analyzed. And again, you can go through and you can see on these large internet broadband connections, is there any traffic in there that relates to the terrorists and criminals and hostile armed forces and others that you might be looking for?
The range of the implemented surveillance programs is beyond imagination. It questions the validity of those who are in the shadows. The optic nerve, revealed by The Guardian, is a GCHQ program that has recorded 1.8 million conversations on Yahoo webcams between the individuals in Europe just to test the automatic systems and the biometric facial recognition. The strictest privacy is violated beyond any legal framework. The freedom of the citizens leaves room for the reason of the state.
What I think is completely illegitimate is that he stole so much material of such high sensitivity, and that journalists are now, piece by piece, exposing the inner workings of intelligence agencies. We will all lose. We will all be less secure as a result of that kind of exposure.
In the midst of the turmoil caused by Snowden's revelations, Obama was paying an official visit to Germany. What was within the area of secrecy becomes a public matter. The credibility of the greatest leaders of the planet is at stake.
Talk about the NSA issue, which obviously caused controversy back home, but also here in Europe. This is not a situation in which we are rifling through, you know, the ordinary emails of German citizens or American citizens or French citizens or anybody else. This is not a situation where we simply go into the internet and start searching any way that we want. This is a circumscribed, narrow system directed at us being able to protect our people, and all of it is done under the oversight of the courts.
However, even the German chancellor does not escape the supervision of the NSA.
Whether the French and the Spanish and the German governments simply didn't know that there was wiretapping and intercepting and searching of electronic communications going on, or whether their objections are hypocritical, I think it's probably a mix of both. There's certainly plenty of hypocrisy.
As if nothing had happened in the previous weeks, in January 2014, President Barack Obama limits the monitoring of the NSA in the U.S. while he renews the all-out surveillance programs in the world. A month later, President François Hollande was on an official visit to the United States.
The example of spying on heads of state and heads of government, and then the symbolic gesture of Angela Merkel showing her portable phone, that has two sides. Of course, you cannot focus on Angela Merkel's phone only, because it's all our phones which are subject to monitoring. And it's not just fixing the problem of whether a certain head of state or 10 or 20 heads of state are or not are followed or not. It's the structural surveillance in our society which needs to be addressed. So I use Angela Merkel's phone as a metaphor for everybody's phone is at stake.
Germany arranges a protest. 25,000 people gather in the venue of the demonstration called Freedom Not Fear. Here, the case of Snowden clarifies the fear of a mass surveillance, which awakens the ghosts of the past. Pataloon, known by his hacker name, created Digital Courage 27 years ago. This is the oldest association fighting for the defense of privacy and data protection in Germany. 13 years after Europe's abortive riposte against Echelon, the U.S. surveillance program for the European citizens, the issue of mass surveillance returns to the front stage of the European Parliament. The institution opened its doors to those who were once regarded as simple protesters.
First round of questions by the rapporteur and the shadows.
The NSA has been guided at every moment by a desire to obscure, evade, sidestep, misinterpret, ignore legal authorities for the purpose of expanding its data collection practices. People concerned about privacy and civil liberties, whether they are in Europe or in the United States, must share an equal concern about that problem.
Now everyone's personal and private lives and associated transaction and data history becomes the equivalent of secret government property, held for years as pre-crime data, just in case it is needed in the future.
We'll be right back.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
The Limelight.
In the United States, the Border Patrol chief has warned the migrant crisis is a national security threat and says his biggest fear is not the 1 million people apprehended so far this year, but the 140,000 known gotaways. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has called the situation at the southern border with Mexico a national security threat, expressing concern about tens of thousands of migrants who have evaded apprehension and entered the United States surreptitiously over the past 5 months. Jason Owens said Border Patrol is closing in on recording 1 million apprehensions of migrants in between ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexico border in the 2024 fiscal year, which started last October. For the third consecutive year, his agency is on track to record 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends at the end of September, Owens said. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. But Owens asked, why are they risking their lives and crossing in areas where we can't get to? Why are they hiding? What do they have to hide? And what are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things, for us, are what represent the threat to our communities. The situation, Owens added, amounts to a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, added, and if we don't know who is coming into our country and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat, and they're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. However, Owens agreed that the vast majority of migrants coming into the United States border are good people. I think the migrants that we encounter that are turning themselves in, yes, I think they absolutely are, by and large, good people. I wish they would choose the right way to come into our country and not start off on the wrong foot by breaking our laws. While a very small amount of these apprehended at the southern border are serious criminals, such as those convicted of murder or other serious crimes, Owens said most migrants are surrendering themselves to Border Patrol agents to escape poverty or violence in their home countries. They're coming across because they're either fleeing terrible conditions or they're economic migrants looking for a better way of life, he said. Customs and Border Protection, the CBP statistics show a tiny fraction of migrants processed by Border Patrol have criminal records in the United States or other countries that share information with American officials. And an even smaller percentage have been convicted of serious crimes. Available data and studies also suggest that migrants in the United States illegally do not commit crimes at a higher rate than native-born Americans. Still, top law enforcement officials, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, have voiced concerns about criminal actors, including potential terrorists, exploiting the unprecedented levels of migration along the U.S. southern border with Mexico over the past 3 years. In both fiscal years, 2022 and 2023, Border Patrol reported over 2 million apprehensions of migrants who crossed the southern border illegally, both all-time highs. Jason Owen said the extraordinary flow of people into the United States is mainly driven by cartels. Asked if cartels were setting the rules of engagement at the southern border, Owen said, yes, they absolutely are. The New York Post has also covered this same story and tells us more. U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owen said the migrant crisis has become a serious national security threat, as terrorists may be slipping across the border with Mexico and smugglers dictate the flow into the United States. They dictate what the flow is going to look like, and we respond to it, Owen said in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation. He said, we try and get out in front of it and deny them the ability to use these areas. But at the end of the day, there's over 1,900 miles of border with Mexico. Under the Biden administration, the United States has endured record levels of migrants pouring across the southern border with Mexico, including thousands who claim asylum and are then released into the country. Border Patrol has reported 1,151,000 encounters at the southern border, according to the most recent tally of numbers through the 2024 fiscal year. The prior year saw 2,475,000 cases, according to the agency. Owens fretted that there could be terrorists and other dangerous people slipping through the system. That number is a large number, but what's keeping me up at night is the 140,000 known gotaways. It's not part of that, he said, referring to the official count, and that's just what we know. That is a national security threat. Border security is a big piece of national security, and if we don't know who is coming into our country, and we don't know what their intent is, that is a threat. They're exploiting a vulnerability that's on our border right now. The border chief noted that most of the encounters are with individuals who are turning themselves in and are fleeing dire economic conditions at home. That doesn't make them bad people, it's just that they're not being respectful of the laws that we've established as a country, he said. Jason Owen stressed that there are dangerous people buried in that population that do pose a risk to the United States. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The U.S. Border Patrol Chief Jason Owens has said the crisis at the southern border with Mexico is a national security threat that keeps him awake at night, in a new interview during which he spelled out the danger posed by millions of illegal migrants who've entered the country in recent years. The U.S. Border Patrol is mere days away from hitting 1 million apprehensions of migrants in fiscal year 2024, which began for the U.S. government last October. What's keeping me at night awake is the 140,000 gotaways, Owen said. The number of migrants who have sneaked into the country undetected since last October. But he asked, what are they hiding? What do they have to hide? What are they bringing in? What is their intent? Where are they coming from? Owens explained are the primary concerns of the U.S. Border Patrol about the gotaways, whose backgrounds and locations are virtually unknown to the U.S. government. We simply don't know the answers to those questions. Those things for us are what represent a threat to our communities, he said. Jason Owens said his department is on track to record some 2 million apprehensions by the time the fiscal year ends in September. The U.S. Border Patrol chief said border security is a big piece of national security, and the illegal migrants being smuggled into the country are exploiting a vulnerability facing the nation at present time. He said migrants who've made their way into the United States this year have come from at least 160 different countries, some of which are many continents away. Routes from Europe and Asia lead to the Darien Gap in Panama, a popular starting point for smugglers leading large groups of migrants north through Central America and eventually into the United States.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Described as an act of self-defense, the Yemenis regard the extensive missile and drone strikes carried out by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the Israeli-occupied territories as a response to the Israeli regime's assault on Iran's consular building in the Syrian capital, Damascus.
We consider the Iranian strikes against the Israeli entity a legitimate attack and a response to the Israeli attacks that violated Iran's sovereignty by hitting its consulate in Syria. The Iranian attack is a legitimate move to punish Israel and is part of measures to stop the regime's ongoing crimes since October 7.
The public sentiment aligns with the official stance as locals overwhelmingly endorse the Iranian strikes, stating that the Israeli regime and its allies only understand the language of force.
The Iranian attack is supported not only by Yemenis but also by all free people in the world. The Iranian response sends a message that Iran's capability is real and that all it was seeking was to liberate Palestine and stop the crimes by the Zionist enemy. Today we are facing an exceptional operation because Iran had not carried out an operation of this scale since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Iran has been characterized by patience and deliberation due to the way it deals with hostile states. This is the first time that Iran has carried out a military operation against its enemies from within Iranian territory. This attack was successful, came at the right time to put the Zionist enemy in its place, and proved that Iran is capable of blowing up Israel.
Over the past few years, Yemeni-Iranian relations have strengthened, especially during the U.S.-backed war on Yemen, initiated by the 2014 revolution. This military campaign aimed to restore a U.S.-aligned former government in Yemen.
People here believe that the recent Iranian attack against the occupied territories significantly impacts Western powers, demonstrating unity among the resistance forces in the region. They view the attack as the beginning of the end for the Israeli regime and its supporters. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
Je suis pas antisémite.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people